Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday the 15th of July and welcome once again to Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and my colleague Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. How are you, Phil?
I'm all dead, David. Hello. How are you doing?
Oh, you beat me to it. I'm not wearing mine.
I'm sorry, I better take the face mask off. It does make it a little bit harder for you to tell what I'm saying.
You better get used to it because we're all going to have to wear them from now on, aren't we?
I know. I went down to the supermarket wearing the other day and I haven't sussed out yet. I've been reading tips of how to stop your glasses steaming up when you're wearing a face mask, but I've come up with a solution. Just this morning, Amazon, I've ordered a pack of cardboard Boris Johnson face masks. So I'm going to be wearing those down the supermarket. That's my solution to everything.
Well, they might not let you in, actually, wearing one of those, Phil.
Well, I hope they're not too realistic, otherwise people will be spitting at me and I'll even be even more risk of disease. I hope people realise it'll be a comedy Boris Johnson mask and I'm not the real person.
Absolutely. But this is a serious issue, I suppose. Wearing face masks, we now have been told that we have to wear them when we go into shops, or we will have to wear them. I don't think it's mandatory from today, is it? But we will have to do it. Obviously, in Scotland, it is already mandatory.
24th of July, I think the date is. Apparently, it's not really very important until the 24th of July.
That did puzzle me, actually. Having decided that we're going to have to wear them, why not just say from now on? Maybe it's because people have to order them online and they have to wait for them to be delivered.
I suspect there's an element of that.
I imagine so. What does it mean for the construction industry? I think there's a bit of confusion in the industry, isn't there, about whether or not they should be worn, what sort of mask should be worn, where they should be worn, all the rest of it. Isn't it? Nothing is very clear, it seems to me.
The government has said nothing about having to wear face masks in the workplace, and that means offices as well as construction sites or farms or whatever, wherever it is that you work. There is chat in the papers this morning that offices might be next or will be next. Construction sites, broadly speaking, and they're not all outdoors, of course, but the outdoor ones tend to be at less risk, especially in this moderately nice summer weather that we've been having. Got somewhere in front of me the quote on this subject from the government guidance, working safely during coronavirus, construction and other outdoor work. So this is the government line on it. This is closely related to, but not exactly the same as, the Construction Leadership Council's site operating procedures that we keep talking about. Discussions these past few weeks and months, David. But the government line says, for construction and other outdoor work, quote, when managing the risks of COVID-19, additional PPE beyond what you usually wear will not be beneficial in the majority of workplaces. Workplaces should not encourage the precautionary use of extra PPE to protect against COVID-19 outside clinical settings or when responding to a suspected or confirmed case of COVID-19. So in other words, for construction sites, don't bother. And it goes on to say, the evidence suggests that wearing a face covering does not protect you, but it may protect others if you are infected but have not developed symptoms.
Yeah.
However, workers and visitors who want to wear a face covering should be allowed to do so. Basically, they're saying don't wear a face mask, but you can if you want. I think my only problem is the lack of specificness about it. I'm a fan of vagueness in rules that we can interpret to our own most appropriate benefit.
Yeah.
But in this occasion, I think some greater clarity is called for.
Yeah, well, I think there's a distinct difference between vagueness and inconsistency. And I think here there's an element of inconsistency. Just discussing this with the family, people have said, well, you know, if you go into Tesco, you've got to wear a face mask now. You haven't up until now, but now you're going to have to wear one. You can go into bars and restaurants and all the rest of it. You can go on public transport. You've got to wear one in public transport. You can't wear one if you're in a pub and you're drinking or if you're in a restaurant and you're eating. You know, what's the difference? Why do you have to wear one on a train, for example, and you don't have to wear one when you're in the pub?
Well, clearly this has got nothing to do with health and it's got nothing to do with science. While it's nice, and I repeat the point I made earlier, is the face mask thing is not to stop yourself getting ill. It's to stop yourself making someone else ill.
Yeah.
It's not like, I was going to say, it's not like smoking, but of course passive smoking is bad also. But it's not a choice you're taking to risk your own health and well-being. It's a choice you're making to risk other people's health and well-being.
Protect others, yeah. Yeah.
I get that a certain state imposition may be required. I don't like it, but I get it. But it's all about, it seems to me that the edict from the government to, that we should now wear face masks, it's in shops and supermarkets. It's to do with the economy. It's to do with making people feel safe to go back into shops.
Yes, yes.
It's a double-edged sword. When I see people wandering around with face masks, it makes me feel less safe. It's a bit like armed police. I remember when I suppose I was probably a teenager, maybe I just left school, the first time I went to Paris, certainly France on my own, I saw armed police everywhere, these armed policemen. And I felt intimidated, you know, because our British bobbies on the beat weren't armed. They might have a truncheon, but that didn't scare me too much. But just the presence of having armed police, I thought, gosh, this place must be really dangerous. The police have got guns.
Yes, exactly. Yes. It creates an expectation, doesn't it?
So, you know, you walk around the shops and you think, if it looked like from some sort of zombie Living Dead film, you think that there are zombies and the Living Dead around.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think you're absolutely right.
But you'll be wearing your face mask, will you? You'll be obeying. You won't be a refusenik.
Well, we do have some, actually. My wife bought some quite a long time ago and haven't worn one yet. But I've been told now, in no uncertain terms, that I'm expected to wear one. Hopefully not in the house, but when I go out, go to the shops or wherever I might be, I will have to wear them. But I don't know how I feel about it. I've got no strong feelings about wearing them or not wearing them. Quite a lot of construction workers will be routinely covering their face anyway, because if they're working in dusty environments, they'll be wearing a mask of some sort or a respirator, even if it's in sort of really hazardous environments.
But I think you'd be surprised how many aren't. I go the other way from that. I think a lot of construction companies have enough trouble trying to persuade their workers to wear the appropriate PPE. At the best of times, even before COVID, I think the idea, you know, if you can't get them to wear face masks or gloves or ear defenders or whatever when they should be wearing them, when they need to wear them for their own protection, I'm not sure we're going to, you know, a COVID mask is going to be a tough ask.
I think it is possible to overdo it. I can remember one particular occasion on a site visit. Oh, I can't remember whose site it was or where it was, and it probably doesn't matter. But they made a real show of being health and safety conscious. And so the entire press corps, there must have been about a dozen of us, all had to sit on plastic chairs in a porter cabin while we were inducted. And then we had to put on the PPE, and there were obviously hard hats, there were rigger boots, waterproof trousers, high-vis jackets, ear protection, eye protection. And one of the journalists here was adjusting the elastic toggles on his high-vis jacket when the toggle slipped out of his fingers and caught him in the eye, whereupon the health and safety chap who was there without missing a beat said, well, you should have put your glasses on first.
I do find the cultural differences, the differences between attitude to risk across different cultures fascinating. And often it's the attitude to risk is created by either law or lawyers. And I take my example, as you know, David, I used to, some years ago, edit a magazine for the crane industry, and I used to visit various factories around the world to see what the hell they're getting on and what they're making. And I'd go to, you know, Liebherr and Demag factories in Germany, and Tadano factory in Japan, and Manitowoc and Link Belt factories in America. And what interested me was that when it came to the design and manufacturing of machines, the German machines had all imaginable safety whistle and bell to stop the crane falling over, having an accident, whatever. All these sort of safety devices as technology. Whereas the American machines, the American culture was that the person in the chair operating should be in charge and not the computer. And they didn't like the idea culturally of the computer deciding what was safe and unsafe. It should be a human decision. And therefore, certainly go back 20 years, they took a much more, I don't want to say relaxed, but a different attitude to the roles of technology in safety. And they didn't want these things to be compulsory, and they wanted to have to be able to turn the safety devices off, whereas in Germany, no, they the machine must be in charge because machines know better than people. So while that suggested a much stronger attitude towards safety in Germany, when you walk down the actual factory where these machines were being made, in Germany, you'd be there in your regular shoes, no high-vis jacket, no hard hat, no glasses. You just walk around up close, watch the welding, have a chat with the welder and walk around. Whereas the American factories, you have to have a safety induction, hard hat, high-vis, steel-toed boots, safety goggles, the full works. And, you know, lines marked out, tram lines where you had to stay between. And in the factory, much, much, much tighter regulation of what was considered to be a hazard or a risk that had to be managed. And that split between site safety and factory safety, if you like, between Germany and the States, I found fascinating. I don't know whether they've merged towards the middle in the intervening 20 years. That was certainly the case then.
Well, that's very interesting, yeah. Anyway, I don't know what the rules are in other countries about face masks and COVID-19.
They're widespread. I've been reading in the news. We are by no means in the advance guard of this movement. If other countries are doing it first.
I think a lot of other people have been wearing them for ages.
Yeah. And we're not just talking about Asia here, or South Asia. We're talking about in Europe, I think, it's become more and more mainstream. But going back to the point about construction sites, And the consistency, I think that what I do feel is that, and I think this is the point that Unite Union has made, is that we need to be a bit more precise about, when we talk about face masks in the workplace, what sort of face mask are we talking about? Mm-hmm. Who should be responsible for providing them and when? And Build UK did a survey of its major contractor members, I think it's 30 odd or so companies were answered the question, three questions. What's your face mask policy for workers who are more than 2 metres apart? What's your policy for when they're less than 2 metres apart? And what type of face masks do you provide? Most of them don't provide face masks. It seems to me that it's up to the workers themselves to... Sorry, not most, but certainly a good number of them. It's up to the workers to provide their own face masks. And I think all the companies should be providing face masks or COVID, in the COVID context. They don't all provide PPE anyway. But there was a broad thrust of who did what, consistency to a certain extent, but not entirely. And I think it's going to. I think the construction industry, the contractors, the employers generally need to, much as they have done with the site operating procedures, I think they need to be more consistent in what type of face mask, whether it's a cheap throwaway one or something with a type 3 yeah. one with a respiratory, or FFP3 I believe it is, with a respiratory hole in it.
Right.
And when and how and where the wearing of them. If face masks are going to move from being compulsory in shops to in offices, then certainly construction sites have got to think more and be yes. ready. As I say, I don't entirely see the point. I'm not a fan of it, but if it's coming, it's coming.
Yeah, and I think if we all have to, sort of toe the line, then that's fair enough. It does seem a little bit, I don't know, we've relaxed so much of the lockdown already, and all of a sudden we're introducing another restriction. It does seem as if we should have been doing that a long time ago, but if that's the way we've got to do it, I suppose that's the way we've got to do it.
But this all seems to be predicated on the fear of a second wave. The stats yes. tell us that, with apologies to those people who are still suffering and have loved ones on respirators, and some people are dying, but we're getting close to certainly down to double, if not single figures, daily deaths. And for context, and my voice of sanity throughout the past few months has been Dr. Phil Hammond, not the former Chancellor of the Exchequer, but the private eye doctor.
Oh yes,
who is consistently putting perspective on how bad and not so bad COVID-19 is. I repeat, of course, it's bad for anyone who's suffering from it, but most fit, able people get over it. And yeah. worldwide, 580,000 people have been killed by it. It's a lot. But that is less than half the number of people who are killed on the roads each year.
Yeah.
It's
all about context, isn't it?
It's a fraction of the people who die of cancer each year. 9.6 yeah. million people died of cancer around the world in 2018. And we haven't banned smoking. Okay, not all cancer is smoking related, but it's a big cause of it. I wonder if the government came out and said, okay, as well as face masks, we're now going to ban smoking. I wonder how that would go down. Well, fine with a lot of people, but not with a loud minority, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Compared to 165,000 cancer deaths in the UK every year. And an awful lot of cancer treatments have been put on hold because of COVID. It's tricky. Yeah. And it's not about science. It's about politics and economics and getting the economy going.
Yeah. And I think that maybe there is sort of renewed concern, as you said, about a second wave of infection. And I don't know if you heard on the radio this morning, Matt Hancock, the health secretary, was being interviewed, and they were certainly pushing him on this issue of whether or not there was going to be a second spike in the winter. And he made the rather sort of obvious point. I mean, I'm not saying that he was not addressing the topic, but he said, well, you know, in the winter, people tend to stay indoors more. They don't go outside so much. They're going to come into contact with other people more often. There's always a higher incidence of respiratory illness during the winter. It's because of our climate. You've got to admit that there is a high risk that there will be another wave of infection anyway. So maybe introducing, getting us used to wearing face masks in all sorts of different environments now might be a way of, I don't know, softening us up for even more restrictive practices later on in the year. I don't know. I imagine that when the winter comes and people are going around with sniffles and sneezes, then you'll be very grateful that they're wearing a face mask.
Better face mask control. I know when I wore a face mask to the supermarket the other day with my glasses steaming up, I was touching my face and fiddling with my ears and my nose and pulling my face mask off a whole lot more than I would ever normally do. And having...
Yeah.
Handled and touched supermarket trolleys and various other things which may or may not have been as clean as they should have been. That's a much higher risk than had I not worn a face mask.
Well, shall we move on to Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and his rescue package that he announced last week? That's generated quite a lot of discussion in the construction industry. Plenty of things to talk about there. What caught your eye about that, Phil, in particular?
Well, I think for me personally, the things I'm more interested in is half-price meals. And as someone I read writing was saying, it's lovely that the Chancellor wants to buy me dinner, but I'm worried about what he expects afterwards. So the hospitality sector, they got their back cut. It's what the construction industry didn't get, I thought, was interesting. I would have liked to have seen the construction industry get a VAT cut, or at least a VAT removal for the B2C, business consumer aspect of the construction industry. I find it ridiculous that if I want to have, you know, windows replaced or an extension built or some home improvements done, I have to pay 20% on top if I go to someone who's VAT registered. But if I go to my jobbing builder next door who happens to be below the VAT threshold, and again, we've discussed this subject before, he'll automatically be 20% cheaper. And it creates this two-tier industry. And a lot of the small building firms regard it as encouraging the black economy and the black market. Now, I don't think just because someone's not VAT registered, because they don't earn enough turnover enough to hit the threshold, automatically makes them part of the black economy. Far from it. It just makes them a sole trader and you know, going about their business in a perfectly legitimate way.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
But it would be helpful to all concerned if the consumer, the domestic consumer for domestic repairs, didn't have to pay an immediate 20% if they wanted to use a VAT-registered builder.
I thought there was he did announce a VAT cut on domestic work.
There's a cut on the hospitality sector VAT rate.
Oh right, okay. Maybe I'm misreading it then.
What we did get in the construction side of things was a £2 billion pot for home insulation schemes. The government will pay at least 2/3 of the cost of any home improvement that reduces energy consumption up to £5,000 maximum. Which sounds, I haven't read the detail, but it sounds awfully like the Green Deal reinvented in some sort of format.
Well, exactly, yeah, which fell flat on its face. I was a bit puzzled why they sort of latched onto environmental things. Maybe it's because if they were going to underwrite somebody's new extension or new kitchen or something like that, that wouldn't actually benefit anybody except the immediate recipient. Whereas I suppose if they are going to subsidise home improvements and actually reduce energy consumption, that's for the greater good. So it's probably a better thing.
But of course, if you get a new kitchen, David, you're not just, you know, making your own home life better. You're actually helping the manufacturers and retailers of kitchen appliances, you're helping plumbers, tilers, electricians and whoever else comes in to do the job, there is a knock-on of any spend of money, which is what the whole scare of this, the economic fallout of the lockdown is. We're all...
Yes, absolutely.
Too many of us, at least, are staying locked down and not wanting to go out and not wanting to spend money, that there's not money flowing through the economy. So this is all about getting money flowing through the economy. I mean, hence the hospitality sector, you know. Eat out to help out is what the Chancellor called it.
There wasn't he snapped actually serving dinners to somebody or... carrying plates to a kitchen or something like that. I didn't.
In Wagamama's, it wasn't just Snap. This was the Treasury's Instagram feed. This is the Treasury's own publicity photos. Had him serving out in a Wagamama's without face mask, without gloves on.
Oh, I heard about it. I didn't see it. Okay.
Fabulous photos. I mean, they're lovely photos, and he looked great in them. But it did kind of send out mixed messages once again.
Was he wearing a face mask? No, let's not go there.
No, exactly that. No face mask, no gloves, but he looked clean anyway.
I noticed something quite interesting because this new, it's not called the Green Deal. What are they calling it? This
The Green Homes Grant, the new one?
Yeah, that's right. The Green Homes Grant, that's it. £2 billion energy scheme to help people improve the energy efficiency of their homes. Of course, that means things like loft insulation and cavity wall insulation, new double glazing and other things to keep buildings warm. I noticed that there's had a press release from a window manufacturer and distributor of plastic windows. I shan't mention their name, doesn't really matter, it's not relevant. Their response I found very strange because they said it causes concern. It's caused concern in the UK's £6 billion glazing industry, which I thought I must have misread to begin with, because after all he's saying...
So why do they want £2 billion stuffed down their neck by the government then? Do they not like the state money?
Very strange, very strange. No, they say that the scheme is encouraging homeowners to delay work, which the sector needs now in order to recover from the slowdown caused by the pandemic.
The scheme doesn't start till September, does it?
No, they've got to wait a whole 6 weeks before the floodgates open and everybody takes advantage of this subsidised home improvement grant and orders plastic windows from them by the dozen. I just can't understand it.
If and when I win the lottery, I'm going to complain that I didn't win it 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, me too. Yes, yeah, I missed out on all that interest.
There are other interesting bits in the plan for jobs. It's all very much about trying to get people back to work and all these furloughed people to avoid having them being laid off permanently, but get them back going. And there's a job retention bonus, which is quite interesting.
Yes.
Any UK employer will get a £1,000 one-off bonus for each and every furloughed employee who is still employed at the end of January next year.
Hmm.
So if a furloughed employee is of marginal economic benefit to you, that might tip the balance for a lot of them.
Yes. Well, it's to prevent a rise in unemployment, isn't it?
Yes. Any business taking on an apprentice in the next 6 months gets £2,000 per apprentice from the government, or £1,500 if the apprentice is 25 years old or older.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all sorts of money going into employment support schemes, training and apprenticeship and all these sort of things. Perhaps one of the big eye-catchers, useful for the house builders, the housing market, was a stamp duty holiday or a temporary raising of the threshold from £125,000 to £500,000 until April 2021. So if you're spending £500,000 on a house... But what was stamp duty before? Was it 20% or more? I can't remember what it was. But
I can't remember. It goes up depending on the purchase price, doesn't it?
It would add thousands onto the price of a home. And so that will be a big help. I don't know if it'll make people... Well, some people will be able to buy a house that they couldn't otherwise buy. It might be a deal breaker for others. Or other people might just use the money they've saved to put a new kitchen in once they buy their new house.
It's probably a widespread benefit, actually. I mean, not just to house buyers, but also to house sellers, because I think that, you know, by upping the threshold, I mean, it's a huge leap from 125,000 to 500,000. By doing that, I think it'll make purchasers far more willing to pay the asking price for a property, because you know, they're not paying the extra umpteen thousand in stamp duty. Yeah. So that might help to ease the flow of transactions and actually prevent any sort of bottleneck of house purchases and sales. So I think that's quite good, actually. It's not just obviously the house building market that'll benefit from that. It's what they like to call the second hand market as well. In fact, primarily the second hand market. But I think it's all sort of good lubrication for the market.
Absolutely. When people buy a new house, they then buy other things, curtains and whatever. It just gets people shopping.
Yeah.
But the best thing about this is, unlike the Green Homes Grant that your plastic window people were complaining about, it's not waiting till September to happen. It happened immediately.
Yeah.
So, I mean, could you imagine if all those housing transactions which were in the works and people, you know, exchange contracts waiting to complete or whatever, suddenly found out that if they waited a few weeks, they would not have to pay stamp duty. Everyone would be pulling out left, right and centre, and the housing market would temporarily collapse. So that had to be immediate. Of course it did.
Yes, of course. Yeah. So maybe that's why the window people are so upset that, you know, they're not getting the same benefits. But anyway, I still think...
There's one other aspect.
Go on.
Sorry, go on, David.
Oh, I was going to say, I still think they're making too much of a fuss. You know, the Chancellor's going to give them, you know, billions of pounds, and they only have to wait 6 weeks for it. So, you know, grow up.
There's one other aspect of the, behind the scenes, really. He didn't mention it in his statement, but one of the things that comes out of the plan for jobs, there has been something going on called a talent retention scheme, which I wasn't aware of, but it exists for various industries. And now there's a construction talent retention scheme, which is basically a recruitment website. Mm. They call it a recruitment portal, but it's an online jobs board. There are already dozens, hundreds of recruitment consultants working in the construction industry, and dozens of well-known websites that people will go to if they're looking for a job or looking to recruit someone.
Yeah.
So I'm slightly puzzled, but everyone seems to think this is a fantastic example of what can be achieved by collaboration between government and industry coming together. And the government's eventually effectively funding this website until April 2021, making it free for you to post your CV up there, and if you're a company looking to employ someone, free to contact directly someone who's posted on this website, I want a job. And I mean, it sounds great, but I thought we already had a million of a hundred of those. So I don't entirely get it. And if it's only free until April 2021, then presumably it's then going to become a commercial service.
Yeah.
And then it's just like all the other commercial services. So why the government didn't just say to one of the larger existing recruitment boards, I mean, maybe I'm missing something. I haven't used a job search website for many. In fact, I've never used a job site website. Last time I was looking for a job, there weren't such things, I don't think.
Well, thank you to people such things as jobs.
Who've taken me on. So I may be missing something, maybe something particularly clever about this website. And I'll give it a plug, since it's government funded and it's owned by the industry or whatever, if I can find out where it is.
What's it called?
I can't even find where I've written it.
Okay, never mind. I haven't got it to hand either. So
if you Google construction talent retention scheme, you will find it. It's something like TLRS or TRS. .co.uk. However, last time I looked, which is last week, it's not operating yet. They announced it, saying it's gone live, and you go on the site and it says, yeah, we've got this great website coming where you can get a job. But it wasn't there yet. Mm. I was expecting lots of recruitment companies to put out press release saying, why is the government, why is the state going into competition with the private sector, an arena that it knows nothing about, that we've been active in for years and years, you know, perfectly happily and successfully keeping the flow of jobs across the construction industry, not just in the UK, but worldwide. Why is the government suddenly trying to take money out of our mouths? But no one's complained. No. So, as I say, maybe I'm missing something, but if anyone has a different view on that and wants to explain to me why the talent retention scheme is needed over and above all the other talent managers, talent finders, talent placement operatives, contact us, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk.
Hmm. It'd be interesting to see what people say about that. Moving on, Phil.
What else has caught your eye?
Well, this is, we've been talking about what's basically good news so far. I mean, face masks might not be good news for most people, but the plan for jobs probably is. But there was also some very sad news, wasn't there, in the last week or so. There was yet another crane collapse, this time in East London, with several people injured and one person killed.
This is awful. A lady, I mean, I don't think she's asleep in her bed. I think it's a daytime thing.
Yes, it was.
But she was in her house, and a tower crane fell onto the roof of her house, and she was found dead under all the rubble. It's awful.
Yeah.
Awful.
Yeah, it was. And obviously it's too early to say with any confidence what actually caused it. It was not a particularly tall crane. I think it was a 20-metre tower crane, a German-made luffing jib crane. I think it had only just been erected. I think it had been erected the day before. We don't know why it collapsed. I think there might have been some... I don't know. I don't want to speculate about what the cause might be.
Well, okay. I know we're not supposed to speculate, but I'm going to tell you why tower cranes fall over.
Okay, go on.
Sometimes they fall over because a very difficult operation is being performed. In fact, the last time the maker of tower crane, this was, Wolf tower crane fell over. I think the last one was at Canary Wharf. I may be wrong. Maybe one since then. I have to go back 20 years or so. And that was during the climbing operation, which is where the crane is jacked up, middle section opens up, and a new piece is lifted into place, and that's quite a tricky operation. And the health and safety executive report into that made it quite clear that the crew who'd doing that had been working all hours, driving through the night to get there on time, and working too hard, driving too far. They were tired and overworked, and it was an element of human error there.
Yeah.
During the climbing of the crane, if memory serves. This one, occasionally tower cranes fall over because they're old, crap, knackered, rusty, whatever.
Not badly maintained.
This was not one of those. This crane was owned by Wolf, the German tower crane company, now actually owns the Wolf tower crane fleet in the UK, which historically was the largest. It's the old Huden tower crane fleet.
That's right.
And Harrington's, and then Wolf stepped in to take over ownership of it because it was an all-Wolf fleet of tower cranes for hire. So it's owned by the manufacturer, and no one knows better how to look after, maintain, put up tower cranes than the people who make them. The main reason why cranes fall over is because of the footings. They are generally well-maintained machines, and if you Google the photos of this tower crane after it fell over, there's no sign of anything snapping, breaking. Okay, I won't speculate, but... okay, I'm speculating. It seems to me that the investigation will be looking very closely at the ground that the tower crane was put on. It has long been a key risk area for the erection of not just tower cranes, but putting up mobile cranes, is who is responsible for the making the ground solid and stable and firm. We now have for mobile crane hire the difference between a contract lift and straightforward crane hire lift, where it makes clear who's got liability for all aspects of the lift. In tower cranes, I'm not sure that it is yet clear enough what is required of whom when it comes to ensuring that the ground is made good and safe and stable for a tower crane to be erected on it.
Presumably it's normally the contractor, isn't it, that provides the base. I mean, for piling, for example, there was a big issue a few years ago with piling rigs falling over, and who was responsible for creating the piling mat. So this is the same issue, is it?
I don't know, but I am pretty damn sure that the people investigating this accident, they'll be looking at the mat, the foundations, the ground upon which the tower crane was put up, and they'll be asking who is in charge of making the ground solid for the tower crane, and what was done by whom and why and how.
Yeah.
Again, I may be completely wrong, but anyone putting up tower cranes needs to know that that is a vulnerable spot in the process, because it's the intersection of two responsibilities, essentially, as we say. And whenever responsibilities intersect like that, there is always going to be scope for confusion or misunderstanding or whatever. Whether or not this whole COVID lockdown business had had any impact on communication, who knows? That'd be pure speculation. The other point I will make very firmly about tower crane accidents is it always takes far too long for anything official to come out about why they happened. The HSC report on the Canary Wharf collapse 20 years ago, that took something like 10 or 15 years to come out. And there have been collapses since then where we've yet to see the official report into exactly why it happened. And this is because it's so sensitive and legal arguments and legal lawyers fighting over things, that all of that has to be done and dusted before anything properly comes out.
There was a suggestion. I think there were plans to introduce, I think it was a tower crane register, wasn't there, at one point?
Okay, that did come out after, that was in the wake of the Battersea tower crane collapse. Because the Battersea tower crane collapse also killed a neighbour, a non-civilian, I think someone washing their car, wasn't it, in Battersea, a bystander.
Yeah. When was that? Can you remember?
Not off the top of my head. I want to say 2012, 2011, but
I think it was longer ago than that.
2006, even, maybe.
2006.
I haven't got that to hand, but it was a while ago. And rightly or wrongly, when someone from outside of the industry, innocent victim, an outsider is killed, the outcry becomes that much greater because it could be any one of us.
Yeah.
Any one of us could walk down the street or sleep in our bed and the tower crane kills us. And so the tower crane register came out on the back of the Battersea fatality. And at the time, I wrote various articles saying that this is tokenism. It has absolutely no impact at all. It's meaningless. It's just simply the crane industry went along with it gladly. Said anything we can do to show that we take safety seriously, we'll do it. If you want us to keep a list, we'll keep a list. We'll do it, folks. Because they don't want cranes to fall over anymore. They've got even less interest in cranes falling over. So they were perfectly happy to have the tower crane register go forward. But they made the point, and they were right to do so, that it wouldn't make a piggin' bit of difference.
It didn't.
I mean, cranes will fall over every so often, in the same way that planes will fall out of the sky. Horrible things will happen. And we just have to do what we can to make them happen less often.
So it was eventually scrapped, wasn't it? The scheme was scrapped because it proved to be ineffectual.
It's part of the one of the red tape initiatives, sweeping away red tape. It fell under that, I think, when the coalition government of Clegg and Cameron, I think.
Yeah. So not much has changed, unfortunately. The tower cranes still fall over. So we haven't really got to the bottom of the problem.
No. And yet tower cranes remain, when used safely, when erected safely and taken down safely, they remain a fantastic tool for helping high buildings go up efficiently, moving materials around.
I have to admit, whenever I see a very tall freestanding tower crane, it always appears to me that it's almost gravity defying, because you've got this long, slender lattice tower with a long, even slenderer lattice boom sticking out and something heavy dangling from the end of it. And anybody who's ever waved a fishing rod around will realise that having even a moderate weight on the end of something long and whippy, it can be quite uncontrollable. So it's a remarkable feat of engineering, a tower crane, and very finely balanced, almost literally in most cases.
Well, I think they're probably more finely, like all machinery these days is more finely balanced than it ever used to, because everything's engineered to within an inch of its life. And there's no wastage. If you look at old crawler cranes of 50 years ago, they were tanks. And now they're only exactly as heavy as they need to be. But anyone concerned about the apparent fragility or the apparent slenderness of a tower crane at the top of it, I would urge them to take a closer look at the bottom of it. They do have great big feet and huge slabs of counterweight of ballast holding them down at the bottom.
And they're often bolted down to
huge
concrete foundations, aren't they? So they are safe, even though they look very fragile from a distance. But yeah, things go wrong occasionally, I suppose.
But this was this bow incident was absolutely appalling, and it's crucial that the lessons that need to be learnt do come out quickly and not in 10 years' time. And while we're at it, please, no. HSE, can we have the reports of the past half dozen tower crane collapses that there have been as well?
Yes, I think that's point well made. Well, Phil, I think have we reached a natural end to our discussion today? Or is there anything else you want to bring up?
Well, sorry to bring it on a down note. I'm trying to find a ray of good news.
Oh, yes.
Output. Construction output in Great Britain grew by 8.2% in May 2020, which is great. 8.2% is a record monthly growth in construction output since ONS records began not very long ago. But this is record growth, folks. Unfortunately, it comes on the back of a 40.2% downturn in April. So we're still 40% down on February.
But I think construction has really shone amongst the other sectors of the economy, because I don't think anybody else has seen an improvement of that sort of magnitude, have they?
Well, I don't think they saw the collapse that construction saw either. But we are bouncing back, we can bounce back, and we will bounce back.
On that upbeat note, I think we can probably draw it to a close, yeah?
Okie dokes. Well, thank you everyone for listening once again to Reconstruction with David and myself. We're still on a fortnightly cycle at the moment. We hope to be with you on back to a weekly basis as soon as we can. You can contact us at podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. Subscribe to Reconstruction Podcast in all the usual outlets. And thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing. We're currently offering a massive 80% discount on subscriptions to the Construction Index magazine. Order yours online today for only £1 per issue. Visit theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine to subscribe.